Hi, I'm Maria Nakaga.
And I'm Jeff Fritz.
And we're back with the intermediate course to ASP.NET Core 2.0. In the beginner's course, we went over a couple of things. We went into an introduction into ASP.NET Core. We looked at the .NET CLI. We built our first console application, went into web applications. We looked at Razor pages.
Okay.
In a bit, and we created our first CRUD application as well.
Cool.
And we had a slight introduction into logging.
Okay.
And in the intermediate day, we're going to go in just a little bit deeper. Like, what's the next step after you've done all the high-level stuff?
Pull back the layer, learn how to tune some of those things just a bit.
Yeah, just a bit. And we're going to have some more stuff on ASP.NET Core, look at the internals. Like, we had a lot of file new projects, but we really didn't explain to you what was going on, right? We're going to look at tag helpers in more details because we had a look at tag helpers in the beginner's course, but we didn't really explain what else you could do with them. Mm. We just say, these are tag helpers and they're great and they change a different color. and we're going to look at authentication and also at SPA. We have a lot to learn today and have a look at the outline and the modules that show up on the site. And yeah, let's get started.
Sounds good.
Yeah.
All right, so I'm going to go and start with a brand new application just so we can set the playing field all at the same place. And I'm going to call this MyMVA. And I'm going to create just a web application and set the authentication to individual user accounts.
And what does that mean?
So what this does is this gives us the ability to have folks log into the application, be authenticated, and we can set up authorization capabilities for those users to be able to access different pieces of the application.
Okay.
What this also does for us, and the trick and why I'm doing it for this course that we're looking at, is it sets up some things for database interaction that I want to be able to push configuration around, so we can talk about configuration a little bit.
Okay, so we're going to look at what comes out of the box when you hit OK.
Yeah, we're going to take a look at that and then learn a little bit about why some of those things work. So I've got the individual user account set up. Let's go ahead and create that. My project's created. It's going to restore packages. Let's take a look at the Solution Explorer here, and I'm going to jump into the startup.
OK.
So as we know, this is how our application, our web application, is configured for us to be able to interact and serve web pages to visitors to our site. Now, if I scroll down here, we already know there's a simple startup here where we're going to capture the configuration for our application. And we'll look at that configuration in a minute here. I want to go on this quick tour to show configure services, where we're going to set up all the various services that are going to be available to the rest of my application, right?
Okay.
These are those cross-cutting services that different controllers or pages or even my tag helpers can use to interact with building content for my application. And the last piece down here is a configure method that takes in a couple of arguments here, the application builder and then the hosting environment. And this configures what we call the HTTP pipeline.
Okay.
So we'll take a look at the pipeline in just a minute, but I want to start by looking at the configure services method here and really dig into what's going on here. Now, you may have heard of the term dependency injection in
yes,
the past,
I have.
Right? Now, what that means is we're going to configure some dependencies that are going to be available throughout our application that we can pass into other locations, other components, other modules of functionality that need those capabilities in order to perform their tasks. So, for example, here on line 29, we add a database context for our application database context, and we configure that to use SQL Server. We're going to use a Microsoft SQL Server database and get the connection string from our configuration. Not bad, but what this means is that in any class that's being used by ASP.NET, I can reference application DB context in my constructor, and it'll be automatically passed in to me.
Okay.
So, to take a quick look at that, if I come over here and I look at my pages and I reach into account and I look at my register page receives all these different things in order to register a new account, including a user manager, a sign-in manager, a logger, and even information to send emails. These things are referring to abstract classes or interfaces, those things will be injected automatically for me, and it saves a copy of those off so that it can handle the registration process.
So where does it save a copy of this off to?
So it saves them off into these private variables up top here on lines 17 through 20. So I have that local copy just for the instance that this page is being run. So I can register new folks. I can access their user records. I can access the sign-in manager and create a password for them as needed, and even log information appropriately or send emails to those folks to say, hey, I created a new account for you on this website. So that's what dependency injection gives you. And you can see these other add statements here. Services add identity. This adds those features that we saw on the register page, particularly the user manager and the sign-in manager. Those come from our security identity features. And we'll see more about identity later today when we see authentication and authorization. So the identity capability here configures that, and it says we're going to store that information about our users inside of our application DB context, that same database context we just defined previously that's using SQL Server. The next one, add MVC, this configures dependency injection and configures those capabilities inside of the MVC framework so that they're available to be injected into other MVC objects.
So even though this is a Razor page application,
yep,
it is still built on top of MVC. So it's just enabling us to leverage.
Oh, yes, okay. Absolutely. So we're leveraging the same MVC capabilities, the same Razor templating engine, the same tag helpers capabilities. Those are all available to us, and we're going to be able to point and use those with the same MVC capabilities available as well. We can still add in controllers and views, and those templates will be available to us throughout our application.
Okay.
The next statement there, add Razor pages options on line 37, this configures those pages that we need to use for authorizing and pages that we want to make sure that folks are actually logged in to be able to access. So you want to be able to have only logged in folks manage their accounts at the manage page, and only folks that are logged in should be able to log out.
Okay.
Right? You run into a weird loop if you're not logged in and you're logging out. But the really interesting thing that you can extend as a developer writing your own application is the ability to register your own services with the dependency injection capabilities. And this line here on 45, services add singleton, this is where we're starting to register our own capabilities. So we saw earlier, the register page receives an email sender here.
Okay.
That email sender is defined right here as referencing the concrete email sender object. Now, if we just take a quick look at that, you can see the email sender is just a class that implements the iEmail sender interface.
Okay.
Has one method, send email async. And for the purposes of the default code, it's just saying I completed that task successfully.
Okay.
If we wanted to develop a true email sender here, we would write something that actually receives that body of that email we want to send, the subject of that email, formats a message appropriately, and sends it out using whatever email service or email server that we have available to us. And your mileage may vary about which one you choose. There's a bunch of services we have available to you on Azure that you can choose, or you might have an email server available on your internal network you may want to use as well.
So which are some of the ones on Azure that people can start taking advantage of?
A really popular one that folks like to use is called SendGrid.
Yeah.
So SendGrid does all kinds of things to make sure that you're not sending spam, to keep you out of spam filters. If you are sending legitimate emails that you don't want to end up in people's spam folders, there's a lot of stuff to help you manage that, and there's a nice console so you can see the status of those emails that you've sent out. So check it out, SendGrid on Azure.
All right,
let me go back over to the startup. Now, this add singleton is configuring the interface iEmail sender. When an email sender interface is requested, we're going to provide a concrete implementation, the email sender class, that matches that and implements it. Now, by using the add singleton term here, it says we're only going to create one email sender class and only one in the entire life of this application. It's a singleton. It's the only one in use. Now, that might be appropriate for some classes where you do only want one of those managing your entire application. But there's other classes like our database context that you want to only be available for each request that comes in, so that when a visitor to our website comes through, they get the same database context, the same database connection string for all the operations they're doing throughout that request. And we can define those types of services by using the command add scoped.
Okay.
Now, a scoped object is available throughout that entire request. You'll get the same object if you request it through a tag helper, through a view component, through a razor page, through a controller. You'll always get the same instance that was created when the first object in that request was created. All right? So scoped is another way for you to define an object that to be processed and sent out. The last one that I want to show is transient. So if you specify something is transient, that means that every time one of these pages or classes requests that type of interface or abstract class, a new instance will be created.
Okay.
So that doesn't make sense for something like an email sender, where we're going to establish that connection to a service like SendGrid, and we don't want to be recreating that connection every time. It's going to be rough on memory usage, processor. Create it once and then use it as needed asynchronously, as you saw in the interface. So transient objects might be some things like a repository pattern or some other communications things that you may want to use so that you're always hitting a new copy of that. Okay?
Okay.
So that's transient, scoped, and singleton status. Okay? So that's a little bit about how dependency injection works here inside of configure services. And all those things occur right here inside of this method. Now, I've actually seen some folks where they'll take the contents of this method and they'll move it out into another class so that they have all of that sitting in an extra file on the side that they don't need to maintain here and accidentally break something that's in one of the other configuration methods of their application.
So they'll take configure services out and put it into its own.
They'll just take out the contents of it. They'll leave that method there and they'll just say, you know, this class.configureServices, and it's somewhere else.
Okay.
So that you have that single responsibility of that file. Where here you've got three responsibilities, you might accidentally change something you didn't intend to.
Okay.
So let's take a look now at the HTTP pipeline down here. HTTP pipeline, this is where we're going to configure how our requests are processed.
Okay.
And the order in which ASP.NET is going to look at each request that comes in, handles it, and then returns it out to the requesting browser or client, whatever that might be. So we've got an if statement up top here to check and see if we're in development mode, if we're in some other environment. We're not going to execute this stuff up top, but this is going to test for an environment.
Okay.
Now, look at how environments are handled in our configuration just a little bit. But typically when you're running here in Visual Studio, it's automatically configured for you as the development environment. So I want to see my developer exception page. When there's an error, I want to be able to see a stack trace, everything that's wrong. But that's not something I want my normal visitors to see, right? We want them to see a better error page, and that's why we have this use exception handler down here. Route to that error page should there be a problem processing the request.
So that would be a 404 or 500. Would those be the exceptions?
This would be a 500.
Yeah.
404 will go to something that the web server will handle.
Yeah.
But yeah, if we get a 500 level error, it'll come into this location. And the error page you can see out there inside of our pages right here.
Yeah.
And it'll put up a nice message.
Okay. An error has occurred while processing your request.
Yep. The next thing here is use static files. So when you have those extra elements that you need in your application, they live under dub root. We saw that, I believe, in the last course.
Yes, we did.
And all of these things, you actually need to tell ASP.NET how to serve them. Otherwise, the Kestrel web server doesn't know what to do, right? Well, we need to put that piece in next, because if somebody's requesting something like a CSS file, we want to stop there and not go into some of these other things. We don't want to evaluate MVC capabilities or try and check for security. Go serve that CSS file, and then we don't need to continue processing at that point. But if you're not requesting CSS images, JavaScript, those static content, we're going to proceed down into this use authentication statement. And that's where we're going to check to see if authentication is required on the current page or the current request.
Yeah.
We're going to verify it and then handle it appropriately.
Okay.
The final thing here is use MVC. We're going to configure the MVC capabilities so that they're an endpoint that we can browse to.
But this is not, isn't it mapping out our routes as well? Yeah.
So this is mapping out routes if we are using controllers with actions. We're not. In this case, we're actually using pages, and pages are routed to whatever is inside the pages folder minus the CSHTML extension.
Yeah, so it's your location, the location you are in the folder.
Yeah, it's that physical location in the folder is what we're serving, but we can still do those controllers with the actions as a route location.
Okay, so the whole point is that you can add a controller to a page set.
You can add it. In this way, you can do API controllers if you're using a JavaScript framework to do some SPA application work. And we'll see some of that a little bit later today.
Okay.
Now, what's important about this is the order that these things appear, right? So I mentioned static files appears before authentication because we don't want to authenticate people before we send them their CSS files. Right? And if we don't include some of these things, if we don't include use static files, it's not going to actually process and return those static files to our visitors. So those are very important things. I'm going to actually change this over to my application here, and I want to show you what happens. Did we remove the static files in the previous course?
No, we don't. We didn't.
Oh, let's see what happens when we pull that out, and let's navigate to our application and see what happens.
It looks like, I have a feeling it might not be the prettiest of pages.
Yeah, because we're going to remove all that CSS, we're going to remove all that JavaScript, and instead of getting that nice Bootstrap framework-enabled site, it's not going to look as pretty. So there's my Chrome debugging from Visual Studio.
And that's new, right?
That's new. So with Visual Studio, you now have the ability to debug your JavaScript in the Chrome browser from Visual Studio. Now, look at this, right? It looks terrible.
I'm looking at it like, what is that?
I know, that's ugly, terrible.
There's a point there, it's like toggle navigation. So that's the line bar.
And that's that hamburger navigation you would have on the left that we're used to seeing in the Bootstrap environment, but none of our CSS was served, none of our JavaScript, and we get just this plain HTML site. Now, that might be okay for my mother-in-law's browser back in 2002, when these the non-technical folks who don't have updated capabilities, it's not that good.
No.
And this is why we need to include those pieces inside of our HTTP pipeline.
And in a specific order.
And in the correct order.
So if you actually took your serve status files and put it under authentication,
let's try that.
The same thing would probably happen.
Well,
give you an error.
Well, we might not get an error. Let's move it all the way down to the bottom. Okay, there it is. So now we've just changed the order a little bit. We're going to rerun. Nothing else has changed. And actually, it works.
Because
those pages that we requested are living out there, and they don't have a name collision with anything that we're... those CSS and JavaScript references don't have a name collision with any of the pages that we've configured. So we kind of dodged a bullet here, but if they did have similar names, it might collide and you might not get it back.
Okay.
So it's not a guarantee that it's going to work. We happen to have some names that fit in all right. Because, right, when you look at the things that we've referenced, right, we have a lot of things under lib, and we don't have a lib page out there that we could be confusing with, right? So... same thing with JS, images, and CSS. We don't have pages that might confuse things out there. So let me stop this. So that's a little bit about the order of things and what you have inside of your configure method here.
Okay.
Now, if you're doing other capabilities with authentication, with authorization, where you want to interact with some other providers, you're going to see them get configured here in this method, and that's hinting again at another module that we have in this course. So that's a little bit about what's going on there. And I've been mentioning application configuration, and I showed a little bit about development environment.
Oh.
Let's actually talk about configuring our application.
Okay.
So up here we have this method, the constructor method, and it's receiving an I configuration, and it's stashing that off in our local property called configuration so that I can access that configuration later to get things like my database connection string. Okay. Now, this request is getting that database connection string out of app settings. And there's my default database connection string. Let me put a carriage return in there just so we can see it. And even then, it still rolls off of one line here because we have this unique GUID dropped in here, right? This globally universal identifier for my database name. We want to have a unique database name just for creating this template database. And it's listening to the local database, the local MySQL database, so that I can write and work with that configuration. Now, inside startup, when it says get connection string, this is a helper method that's going to look for a connection strings object inside of configuration and then look for the default connection object inside of that connection strings. So default connection, and it's going to grab this value out of my JSON and serve it.
Okay.
Now, all of that is configured by default inside of program CS.
All right.
Right. Where we have create default builder, use startup and build. The default builder will grab things like that app settings, load up its values into configuration, and start reading it. It also loads up environment variables. Now, that sounds kind of weird to some longtime .NET folks to start reading environment variables into configuration.
Okay.
Right?
Where was it before?
Exactly. If we had to read environment variables before, we actually had to write some custom code to reach into environment variables and figure out where are the values that I want and inject them appropriately.
Yeah.
So what we've done is we've made it part of the framework so that it's built in and it's layered as the last thing into your configuration. So what you can do is you can actually change some of the settings here that are in app settings by adding an environment variable that has the same name.
All right, so...
So you could add a logging environment variable, but logging actually has this hierarchy here. We overwrite items in that hierarchy by separating with a double underscore.
Okay.
So that sounds kind of weird. Let me show you how the environment variables appear inside of our pages. I'm going to go to the home page, and then we'll take a look at starting to inject some of these other things. I'm going to inject our configuration here with the @inject directive.
Okay.
And I'm going to inject, it is Microsoft.extensions configuration iConfiguration.
Okay.
And I will call it configuration.
All right.
So I've got my configuration coming in, and I'm going to go down here to the bottom, and I want to put in the, you know what? No, let's clear out this page.
Oh, yeah, let's do that.
Don't need anything in here. Let's just clear this out. And I'm going to put on the host name of my machine. So I can do that by saying this is my machine name. And I will say @configuration.
Okay.
And every Windows machine actually creates an environment variable called computer name. So I will reference that. Now, by using configuration and then the indexer computer name, it's going to find that value inside of my configuration and drop it right here.
All right.
So let's see what happens when that runs.
So it should say Jeff's Awesome Computer 2020-49 or something like that.
I think it says Jeff's Yoga or something like that. There you go.
Ooh, okay.
This is my machine name, Jeff's Yoga. Okay? Now, that's great. It's my machine name. It's an environment variable that is existing and is native on my machine. I've injected and I've put it on my page. That's not valuable, but what might be valuable is if I have an app setting sitting out here that's something like my Twitter key. And maybe it's an ID to get you into Twitter.
Yeah.
And it is Twitter secret key. Right? So in my machine, when I'm building this, I can reference and use that on whether it's my page or my startup. If I come over here and I'm going to access that same value my Twitter key, if I put that there, restart the application.
It should probably have your Twitter.
It should have the same value coming back. There it is, Twitter secret key. But when I get out to my production environment, I don't want that same value that I wrote in development in production. I actually want to overwrite that with an environment variable. So inside of Visual Studio, you can manage your environment variables
that so how did you
use
get there?
At build time. Oh, thank you. Let's step back. So if I go to Project, my project name's Properties. And if I go down into, I think it is...
It's Debug, maybe?
Yes, Debug. So we have an item here that says Environment Variables. And we have this initial variable defined here, ASP.NET Core _ Environment. And it says Development. That's the environment name that we've defined for this machine, okay? So we've instructed it that this is a development environment so that those things over here inside my startup where I say, is this development? This will be executed.
Okay.
If you don't set this variable up front, it defaults to being production. So what I'm going to do is I'm going to override my Twitter key here by setting another environment variable, and I will call this production key. So now if this was in a different environment, that value is now going to take hold, and that one will supersede what's in the app settings JSON. And we'll see this come up in just a second.
It seems like a more secure way to do this.
It is, but there's an even more secure way to do it.
Mm-hmm.
So there's production key came up, but if that environment variable wasn't set, I would still get the old Twitter key. Now, let me stop this one more time, and I want to show the final way that we think folks should start looking at doing this.
Okay.
If we take a look at app settings, right, I actually have my key sitting here, plain text. Do you know how many folks commit that into source control, shared source control, and it's just available out there? I've done it.
I'm sorry.
We want folks to be more secure by default.
Yeah.
So instead of putting that there, what we can do is we can use something called user secrets. Now, user secrets is a feature that's available on ASP.NET Core. It's an extra capability here that I can access inside of Visual Studio by coming down and choosing Manage User Secrets when I right-click on my project. When I choose that, you see I get this new file here called secrets.json. And when I mouse over it, check that out, it comes up and it's giving me a tooltip that's showing it's under C, Users, Jeff, App Data, Roaming. Let me go back over it again. Microsoft User Secrets. And then it's my application name followed by a GUID and then secrets.json. So this isn't so much an encrypted file as it's a file that's not in source control.
Okay.
Now, what that means is I can take that same value that's over here inside my app settings, and I'm going to paste it in here. There's my Twitter secret key, and I'm going to change this to should not use. And I should not get that value coming out. Instead, I want to get this secret key coming out.
Okay.
Now, here's the best part. By default, if there's a user secrets configured in my application, inside of Program CS, when it says create default builder, it'll load those before the environment variables if it exists and we're in development mode. So I wrote that secrets JSON. There's my Twitter secret key. I'll run this one more time. Everything's running. Here it comes. And I get Twitter secret key coming from my secrets JSON, so it's not committed into source control. And my other value that's sitting out there inside of my app settings, should not use, that's committed. I don't care who sees that.
Yeah.
That's a dummy value that nobody really needs to pay attention to. But I'm keeping my data that I'm using for development purposes more secure. So your development connection strings, put those in a secret location so that folks aren't stepping on each other and they're not sharing some of those secret values you don't want to make public.
So I would suspect if you were using keys for third-party providers, you'd probably want to keep them somewhere, in Azure, like an Azure Key Vault?
Absolutely. That's a great tip. We have Azure Key Vault available for you that you can put some of those key values into for those third-party providers, like maybe your Twitter authentication, your Facebook authentication. Put those keys into the Key Vault, and then we can automatically load those in with a different provider, and they'll apply when you're in the production space. Very cool stuff.
But what we're doing right now would also work in a production space as well.
Yes. You can use this. Those secrets JSON files, that doesn't go with you into production.
Okay.
The user secrets don't get used in production. But instead, you can write an environment variable to override this inside of your production space. Azure App Service has a console where you can write in your environment variables that you want to use, and they will overwrite these values.
Okay, and keeping our keys nice and safe, so there's no way for people to see it.
Absolutely. No way for people to see it.
So I can't do F12 and try to search around and find it?
Yeah. Nope.
Okay.
You won't see it. It's all in memory and hidden behind the scenes. It's not on disk, and it's not being sent down to the browser unless you write something out that's actually emitting it to the browser. So that's a little bit about how you can pass things in and out of there. The last thing that I want to show is, what if I want to change something like the log level here from default warning to maybe I want to set it to my trace level? Well, that's a little bit further down. It's more hierarchical, right? It's logging, then log level, then default. How do I set that value? What we do is we can set our configuration to be separated by colons, and it'll come down and it'll read it in just work. So let me go back into my project properties, and I'm going to define another environment variable, and this one is going to be logging log level default.
Okay.
So logging log level default, and it's separated by colons.
Okay.
And now I'm going to set this to trace. And now when I run my application, I'll get all my trace level information sent down.
And that's everything, right? Trace is like pretty much
Trace is pretty much everything, and you're going to get all your info coming down. So I have a whole different level of logging coming down to me.
And I believe you can also view this in Visual Studio as well.
Yes, you can view this in Visual Studio if you have your application insights configured right here.
And
I can click
about that.
And I can see the exact same log information coming down, what's been sent down at the trace level as well. So very easy to get started and use environment variables, user secrets, and your app settings JSON to configure. And then you can read those values out by using configuration and then that square bracket indexer so that you can write out configuration information into different classes and different features inside of your application. And the configuration object is now registered with dependency injection by default. I didn't have to add anything into startup. It's just there for me. So I can request an iConfiguration inside of a page or a controller, and it'll just be available with all the configuration for your application.
Okay. Wow.
Yeah. That's a lot to peel back just from that startup page.
It is.
So I think that's all we have for this module.
Yes, we do. It was a great, great insight to the ASP.NET Core internals.
Yep.
We hope that you feel ready to go and explore and play around with it more. And we're going to take a quick break, and we'll be back later.
Hope you join us.